Ben Moore has been in love with bees for as long as anyone can remember. And as far as we can tell, the feeling is entirely mutual. Although he still sometimes feels the sting of his passion. Hang around, learn a little. It's as sweet as honey and always a buzz. It's the Ultimate Pollinators Podcast with Ben, his friends and associates, and of course, Ben's bees.
Hey everyone, Bees with Ben. I'm buzzing with excitement for this episode because I have got the guru of all gurus when it comes to queen bees and everything bee related. Absolutely pumped and excited for this episode. Absolutely awesome. You're going to absolutely love it. On the line, I have the amazing Corinne Jordan from the Bee Lady Apiaries. Thank you so much for your time, Corinne.
Thank you, Ben, for having me.
This is absolutely awesome. So, questions. Obviously, I always like to start off with a question, you know what I mean, because people like the journey, because everyone's got a different journey, how they start off with bees. Tell us about how you start off with bees, please, Corinne.
So about 16 years ago, I started off my beekeeping journey, and it wasn't very popular back then, mainly because my son had an interest in ants, and I was looking for a career for him and thought that his ant interest might convert into an interest in beekeeping.
Okay.
But he turned out to be allergic to bees.
Okay.
With a really bad trip to a hospital involved, and I got hooked in the meantime.
Awesome. I love it. Is he okay now, your son, all those years later?
Well, I breed some pretty quiet-tempered bees, so he has had a go at beekeeping since he's in the past year or so, and hasn't had any problems because they're obviously not chasing him or trying to sting him anymore.
Yes, true. That's a very good point. And now breeding queens, and we've got lots to talk about because you're doing something really cool. And I'm going to put in the show notes as well the websites. The one we'll talk about towards the end is the Bee Genetics. But is as far as like your business as the Bee Lady Apiaries, is queens your focus, Corinne?
Yeah. So back in about 2012, I'd always had an interest in queen breeding, but around about 2012, I really decided to refocus my business and concentrate on queen production and queen breeding. Before that, I was doing honey production. I was kind of a sort of semi-commercial sideliner type beekeeper. I had around about 50 to between 50 and 100 hives.
Okay.
And I mostly did sold my honey retail at markets or to small restaurants and those sorts of things.
Okay, awesome. And now you're in Queensland. Whereabouts in Queensland? Is it the Sunshine Coast?
I'm southeast of Brisbane.
Oh, Brisbane. So okay.
About halfway between the Gold Coast and Brisbane on the coast.
Okay, awesome.
Just near the Logan River.
Yes, yeah, living the dream. That beautiful weather that you have up there.
It is beautiful weather, but you wouldn't believe it because my family are all wearing their snow gear.
Oh, really?
we're a bit wimpy, as Queenslanders. We had a lovely sunny day today. I think it was 23 degrees.
Oh, rub it in. Thanks, Corinne. Rub it in. I'm in Melbourne. I'm in my studio now. There's no heating. I've got about 5 layers on. So rub it in. That's funny.
No, the weather definitely makes life much easier to cope with up here. It's a beautiful place to live.
Oh, absolutely amazing. I used to live in Noosa for a few years, so I do appreciate that weather. I don't know why I come back to Melbourne. Anyway, love Melbourne. On the subject of sort of weather, so with the queen breeding, can you do it almost all year round? Like, is there a peak time? How's that work?
Yes, we're pretty lucky with the weather here. We have a very long season, okay, which I think makes us fairly unique in our It means that I've got a lot longer window to do my breeding work in, and drones are flying for longer, and queen breeding can happen just about all year. I think probably May, June, July is a little bit dodgy.
Okay.
But definitely August through to April.
Yeah, okay. So that's
would
awesome.
be a regular season.
Awesome.
And some beekeepers go through winter. I try and have a break.
Yes.
Because otherwise you just burn out.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Exactly. When you're doing them throughout, that's exactly right. What about, obviously, I'm the same. I have some downtime during winter. What do you like to do? It's interesting what
during my downtime.
Yeah.
I'm really bad. I still do bee stuff.
I don't know. Most people like that.
My downtime is catching up on my reading and research and what's happening in the world and watching YouTube videos and, just catching up basically on all the new wonderful stuff that keeps happening in the world of beekeeping.
It is. It's always evolving and changing in there. It's so true.
Yeah.
So in regards to breeding queens, what makes a good queen breeder?
What makes someone who has determination and persistence and resilience and just sticks at it and keeps good records and has good observation skills and will put in 110%.
Yes.
And puts your bees come first.
Yes, it is, yeah.
And you have to live the life where you can put them first. And, so it's a lot to ask of a person, really, but that's the way it is. So if you're not prepared to put bees first, then don't become a queen breeder.
Yeah, that's very good points. Well, what about negative aspects? Is there any negative sides to, breeding queens?
Not from the actual breeding itself. What are the negative? Well, it's the amount of effort and time. It's time consuming.
Yes, yeah.
And there's a lot of effort for very little financial rewards. Personally, it's rewarding in other ways, seeing what you can achieve as far as in making the stock improvement. But I'd say that it's generally not a particularly financially sustainable activity.
Yeah, okay.
Yep. But I've really enjoyed the improvements in the bees that I've made over the years. It's very much visible these days that their temperament is amazing. They're still really productive. The brood patterns are still really good. I've bred most of the swarminess out of my bees because I don't like getting bees out of trees all the time. That's really annoying.
That's a good point.
So they stay in their boxes now.
That's
and
awesome.
The disease resistance is definitely there. Working on chalk brood still and eliminating other diseases from the breeding population, like susceptibility. I should say susceptibility to diseases like European fowl brood.
Yes, okay.
And susceptibility to chalk brood.
Okay.
What I'm working on, eliminating those. Breeding is always an evolving activity. You can't focus on all traits at one time. You sort of work your way through and you do some work on one set of traits and say, like, I'll work on temperament and then I'll look at the bees and go, well, they're getting a bit too much chalk brood, so then I'll concentrate on chalk brood, and then the brood patterns will start to look a bit scattered rather than nice, full, solid brood patterns. So then I'll start looking at which crosses I can make with which bees to bring back the brood patterns and the vigour in the colony a bit more. So, it's just a constant. You just work through a process and keep changing and juggling and creating until you get close to what you are aiming for.
Yeah, trying to achieve. I did think of one negative. How do you go with this? Like, everyone wants queen bees at around about October. Is there like this, just like this, you know, phone calls, text messages, emails? How do you go with that? Because that side of things can be quite a struggle, you know what I mean? It's sort of, you know, bringing the queens is one thing, but then you've got all these, that side.
Yeah, there's definitely more demand than supply, and there probably always will be because of the workload and the commitment and the price of queens.
Yes.
It doesn't really cover you for giving up your life, basically, for 10 years.
Yeah, that's right. That's a very, very valid point.
I'm put in pretty long working weeks, especially in spring. And I think a couple of years ago I thought, well, how long am I actually working? I should sit down and figure this one out and just actually take the time to figure out how long my working week was. And it was 78 hours.
Wow.
And I thought, that's ridiculous. I'm working 78-hour weeks. I'm going to stop there. So the next week, I worked 72 hours. And then the next week after that, it was about 76. I thought, oh, okay, well, I've obviously been doing this all along and I didn't realise I was doing it, and I can't change it and still achieve the same results.
That's an interesting breakdown. Actually, yeah, I appreciate that, you know, that breakdown of, you know, looking how many hours per week during the spring and just doing that. That's,
the spring in particular is flat out. And, I'm out in an apiary all day, and I'm just trying to keep up with making sure that my breeding population has got what it needs so it stays there and I don't lose it, basically.
True.
Yeah, so they don't, like, run out of room and swarm, or if they're in last season's inseminated breeders and then they need room to grow, they're going into bigger boxes and all those management activities that normally occur in an apiary happen in mine. But I also have all the breeder care on top of that I need to do, make sure there's drone comb in the right places and things are moved around and the next season breeders have commenced in the middle of all of that, so that I'm not losing the lines because some of them are getting old.
Yes, yep. So the actual strain of bee you're sort of working with, so that's an Italian, is it like Cordovian Blonde? What type of, like, sort of,
So it's mostly the Italian bee I work with, and I have bred the Cordovan, which is a recessive colour that occurs naturally in the Italian lines. But you need the colouring to be in the both parents for it to be expressed. So the drone's got to carry it, and the queen has to carry it as well.
Okay, so the genetics. Okay, so both are carrier, and there's a lot of listeners wouldn't have heard of that particular strain of bee. Tell us all about it. Like, what's, you know, obviously I know there's a colour, but where's the history?
They're a very pretty bee, I guess, and a lot of people say, I want all these other traits in my bees. I want them to be productive, and I want them to be able to cope well with pests and diseases. But we don't really care about colour. But when it comes to shove, they say, but by the way, if you've got any of those cordovans, we would like one of those.
Yes.
So they are very pretty bee. I get a lot of artists and photographers in particular who put in requests for Cordovan bees because they just glow in the sunlight.
Yeah.
Probably one of the other major advantages of them for a breeder is that you can track genetic traits. This is getting a bit complicated, but you can track your genes, I suppose is a better way of putting it, or the work that you're doing by adding the colour to that group of queens you're breeding.
Okay.
So then you can use that colour marker to track say I might have it to, say I'm breeding for AFB
yes.
resistance, and I will try and mark my AFB resistant queens with that cordovan drone colouring or cordovan colouring, I should say.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah.
And so now, is that predominantly you're doing grafts, Corinne? Because you do a little bit of artificial insemination, don't you?
Yeah, I do all my breeding by instrumental insemination.
Okay.
So, yeah, I fully control all the mating by instrumental insemination. So I actually select all of the drone stock and all of the queen stock and then inseminate to achieve the results.
Okay.
That I'm looking for.
So, wow, that's fascinating. Well, talk us through that artificial insemination. So obviously this is, being audio, but sort of paint us,
how do I paint a picture of insemination?
So while people are driving.
Yeah, it's a really, probably a difficult process to explain.
But like in the sense of, you're grabbing your virgin queens and then you've got some drones there. Yeah, talk us through that process.
Yeah, well, firstly, you need the drones. So you're grabbing the drones. I usually do it when they take their flight time because they're less likely to be contaminated with having not gone to the toilet. That's
okay.
The most diplomatic way of saying that. So I catch them when they're returning from mating flights. You also know that they're likely to be a mature drone who's got lots of semen and wants to do the business.
Yes.
So then they are kept inside a little, like a cage with a net, and then you just take them out individually, squeeze them until they're reproductive organs pop out and hold them underneath a glass syringe so you can see what you're doing. You can see the movement of the semen up into the syringe. Okay. And you use a syringe, like, I don't know how to describe it. It's like a bigger syringe. And you just turn, it sucks the semen up into the glass tip.
Okay.
Basically, and then you collect enough to inseminate one queen, which is around about 8 to 10 microliters. Each drone usually yields about 1 microliter.
Okay.
And then you take your poor virgin queen.
Yep.
She's not really a poor virgin queen. Out of her nuclear size, pre-gas her with some CO2, put her in a little tube to hold her. And which is getting a constant stream of CO2 so that she's put to sleep, and then you bring the needle down into her reproductive area and inseminate her with about 8 to 10 microliters of the semen, and then put her in recovery, and she goes back into her nucleus hive.
Wow. Now you said recovery. So is that before she goes back in the hive?
I like them to wake up before I put them back in the hive.
Okay. So they've got to wake up. Is that because
recovery is usually a little cage with some food and a few attendants to look after them.
Okay.
And then, I always have attendants looking after my queens when they're being inseminated.
Okay. And how long are they staying in recovery for?
Not long, usually only about half an hour, an hour.
Yeah, okay.
Depends if I'm doing a batch. It might be a bit longer if I've gone off and taken a lunch break or something in the middle of it. But, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And when now she goes back into the nucleus, into that colony, when will she start laying eggs? How soon?
She would usually start laying about 3 to 4, 5 days afterwards.
Okay.
I don't normally check them before 5 days, and the earliest I find them laying eggs is 5 days after insemination.
Okay, 5 days. Okay, fascinating.
Mm.
Interesting. And then, wow. And how many would you sort of artificially inseminate, on average per season, roughly? Is there a number?
Around about Yeah. So each season varies, depends on how busy the honey production side of things and nucleus hives and everything else is, and how many production queens I'm producing. But so on a really busy season, I do about 100.
Wow.
And on a not so busy season, I do closer to 200.
Wow. Okay. Well,
yeah. So there's a big variation. So it averages about 150 a season.
About 150, because that's incredibly time consuming. You know what I mean? Like you've got those two components of actually grabbing those queens, using the CO2 to sort of, put it to sleep, and then, getting the drones, catching those drones as they're coming back, as you're saying. But, you know, they've had a poo flight, so they're, So there's all these little variables there. And I'd be correct in saying that you'd be only one of literally five people or less in Australia that does it.
Oh, I think there might be a dozen. We've trained a few people, and I know Elizabeth Frost has too at Tocal. There's probably a few more out there doing it. There's quite a few people that learn how to do it, and then the process takes a lot of skill.
Yes.
And it's very frustrating too. It takes a few years to figure out what's going wrong when something goes wrong, and a lot of people give up.
Okay.
And there is a lot of different components to the actual technical skill of it, like you've got to source the solutions that go in the needle that you're using to control diseases, viruses and things, or infection.
Okay.
Infection's the right word.
Yes.
So you have to, you don't have to, but you have to be very careful with your sterility and keeping everything clean.
Okay, keeping everything nice and clean. And obviously that's important. Is there one other aspect to artificial insemination that can go wrong?
There is probably a lot of different processes. The one that I struggle with still to this day is introducing them afterwards to colonies, because they haven't had a actual mating flight. They don't give off the same odours, and the bees don't sense them as a properly mated queen. And they're not very easy to introduce to a colony because of that. They need a very slow process of introduction, and the hive that you're introducing them to has to be very, very queenless and not able to raise anything.
Interesting. Okay, that's fascinating because you could go to all that trouble, you know, as I said, with the queens, creating that virgin queen, collecting the semen from the drones, and then you've got the process of artificially inseminating her, putting in the recovery, and then boom, you got to put her, into a nucleus hive, and then they smack her on the head.
For no apparent reason, they kill perfectly good, beautiful queen that you've given the best semen from the best drone.
Yes.
And then they'll keep one I had one once upon a time. You have accidents when you've been doing this for 11 years. One time I accidentally glued this poor queen's leg to her head.
Yeah, okay.
When I was putting her number disc on, and I was really mad with myself. But I put her in the colony anyway and thought, oh, well, that they'll just kill her. They didn't.
Oh, they didn't.
They kept her, and she was walking around like Quasimodo in there for about 6 months.
And
laying eggs. Laying eggs, yes.
How interesting that. Sometimes you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Like, as you're saying, you do the most perfect scenario and everything's just like absolute perfect, and you put the queen in and then they smack on the head and you do something else and then they accept that. Geez, it's a life of bees. I suppose that's why we all do it. You know, this fascination with it. So that process is absolutely incredible.
And I had another one day, again, perfect queen, perfect insemination process, and I put her in recovery, which involved sitting her underneath a little queen cage.
Yep.
And she escaped into the room, and she, of all places, went in a corner where this spider came out and got her.
Oh, no. A spider of all the places. Oh,
so,
no.
Yeah, so things do go wrong. And then I've had, you know, I've had other queens that have had some abnormalities, like one that had a double stinger. That was quite interesting.
No
and I
way.
Thought,
wow.
I thought after I inseminated her, I thought, well, really just wasted my time doing that. But I think she's still going. She was early spring last year I inseminated her, but she, because she's got the double stinger and the stinger is the mechanism to guide the eggs out, her egg guidance system doesn't work very well and she pops all these eggs into one cell all over the place.
Oh, wow. How fascinating. Wow.
So she's really wasting her stored eggs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Because her little, as you say,
ovaries.
Yeah, her little guidance system is it's not working. It's like, yeah. It's now. Would you recommend? Let's say someone's been keeping bees for some time. Would you recommend that they give AI a go? Or like,
I guess if they're that way inclined, that they want to achieve something with breeding. It's one of the ways that you can easily control mating.
Yeah,
and let's face it, bees are really difficult to control their mating when they're out flying in the middle of you don't know where. I think that unless you have access to an island or you have a system like Joe Horner has where he does a timed mating system, insemination is definitely one of the most successful methods of controlled mating.
Yes, yep.
You know exactly what's going in there.
That's, yeah. And because the other thing is too, you're looking at a couple of $1,000 for all the instruments, aren't you?
I think to get decent equipment nowadays, I always tell people to invest in a really good microscope. It makes a huge difference. Yep. And a good microscope will set you back about $2,000 or $3,000 alone.
Oh, wow. Okay. Before you even look at all the other glassware and.
So some of the insemination equipment you can usually get for around about $2,000. So a good setup is going to cost you about $5,000.
Yeah, about $5,000. Excuse me. And where's it made, Corinne? Is this sort of equipment, like not so much a microscope, but the actual, you know, that glassware, is that all made in like, you know, the States, America? Is there a country
There's a lot of it is done in Germany. I think you can get some out of the States. And there is a supplier in Melbourne now, down in Victoria.
Wow.
The apiarian. And he does the glass tips too, and he makes them to order, I think, which is really brilliant because before we used to have to wait for them to come in from the USA and they would take forever.
Yeah,
so it's good to have someone in Australia who can supply some of the insemination gear.
Okay, that's okay. Interesting. Okay, so what was that, apiarian?
The apiarian.
Apiarian, okay.
Gary Kendall is the name of the person in Victoria.
Interesting. Hmm. Well, there we go. And now we're going to talk, that was absolutely fascinating, talk about the artificial insemination. Now, now I'm going to put
there
on
There was a lot more to it.
Oh, of course, yeah. Oh, that's right. You've just touched the surface. Like that was just a...
haven't done any for a few months now. Feels really weird talking about it.
Yes.
When I set up every season to get back into it, I have that moment where, like, I go through the what do I need? Have I got it all right? Now what do I do next? It's like you do remember once you get into the swing of it, but there's a lot of little processes and things that need to be ready for it to all happen and the timing.
Yeah, the time. And actually, one more question on the artificial insemination before we get into the bee genetics is, what can you do? You need to be like, you know, for, saving myself, you know, I'm 6 foot three, you know what I mean, got big fat fingers. Is it like, you know, do you have to be a little bit more articulate in how you, or it doesn't really matter? Like, you know what I mean?
I've taught all sorts of different people, yep, and sometimes the people that you think are really going to be awkward turn out to be the best at it. I think you've got to have patience.
Patience, okay.
And, I think patience and fine motor control skills and good eyesight will help.
Yes, okay. Okay.
But, yeah, the ability to just sit down and concentrate and focus.
Yeah, okay.
And, and have that patience. Yes. To stick it through, because it can be a bit tough.
Yeah, so if you
with getting the hardest thing is to get the semen off the drone.
Okay,
the actual insemination of the Virgin Queen takes about 2 minutes tops.
Okay, so the actual that's the hard component. That's
The things people have difficulty with is getting the semen without getting mucus. There's the semen sits on a layer of mucus, and so it's getting a nice what's the word for it? Viscous.
Yeah.
Or the right, knowing the right age of your drone so that you're not getting semen that's all claggy and old.
Okay. Yep.
And so it's I can't describe it. It's the way it flows from the tip.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it moves in a certain way. It's one of those things you have to do a lot of,
and then you realize that
there's different, that the semen feels different and it feels wrong.
Okay. Well,
so that's one of the, and the other processes with the Virgin Queens is finding the right area to get the tip of the glass syringe into.
To get that right spot, their reproductive area.
There's a bit of a fold. It's kind of a crinkly system where it's shaped like a lightning bolt.
that kind of shape. Yes.
You've got to sort of go through, get on the right angle to get through that system.
Yeah, wow, that's truly amazing and absolutely incredible. Like it's sort of artificially inseminating a bee. Absolutely incredible.
Very fine work.
Yeah, fine work, and incredibly fine. Exactly. So yeah, amazing. Now I'm going to bee genetics. Now I'm going to put this in the show notes. So website, which is beegenetics.com.au. So for the listeners, jump on and check this website out. Now, obviously the last, I think it's coming up to almost a year now. We're all aware of this little sucker, this little variety destructor in Australia. And the issues, and the DPI are doing a great job, you know, trying to control it. But let's pretend that they don't and it gets out. You're working on something truly amazing, Corinne. Tell us about this sort of breeding for resistance. Tell us all about that.
Thank you for that. Yeah. So breeding for varroa resistance has always been in the background for me. I've always wanted to do it, and I've always been looking at different ways we can do it in Australia, which is the awkward thing for us is that we don't actually have an active mite population.
Okay.
But it always made sense to me that we should prepare for the inevitable, because we're really the last continent and have been for over 20 years now that is varroa free. So I never liked the chances of, in my career as a beekeeper, that we would remain varroa free. So I've always investigated methods. And probably the most useful one is hygienic behaviour.
Okay.
So bees have natural hygienic behaviour. There's an ability in bees where they will sense that there's something wrong with brood. It's either dead or it's diseased, and they will uncap it and remove it. So that's how the hygienic behaviour mechanism works.
Okay. So
they're sensing that the brood is not well, and then they uncap it and remove it. So there is also that behaviour. There is a specific behaviour to varroa that they do called varroa sensitive hygiene, where bees detect that there is a varroa in the cell and they uncap it and remove it.
Okay.
And
remove the larvae as well, or just remove?
Yeah, they remove the larvae.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Basically. Yeah, which breaks the reproductive cycle of the varroa. There are probably some other mechanisms as well where they might do something to the larvae. I mean, not the larvae, the varroa mite, but the actual hygienic part is uncapping the cell and removing the diseased brood or the varroa mite brood.
And how long have you been working on this for, Corinne?
So I've always done hygienic behaviour testing,
yep. Okay.
Going back to about 2014.
Okay.
So I've been breeding for hygienic behaviour generally, which is looking at diseased and dead brood and uncapping and removing that. But because, as I said to you earlier on in the call, during my downtime, which is May, June, July, well, I always catch up on all the research from around the world. I came across Kira Wagner's research based on using odours to detect varroa in cells that she'd done. So she'd found out that a certain two hydrocarbons were elevated in unhealthy brood that was being attacked by varroa, basically. And she managed to synthesize that odor into a spray, and then found that when you spray it on the capping, bees that would normally detect a varroa in the cell, they will exhibit the same behaviour, but they will uncap and have a look for the varroa. So the spray was mimicking the varroa in the cell.
Wow. This is truly absolutely amazing. And so this is almost like a breakthrough to, you know, creating this odour, the spray to actually help, you know, I mean, the bees, the bee colony. And it's almost a... I think of it as almost being this natural organic way of doing it, you know, as opposed to using these, you see overseas, especially New Zealand and the States, they use these chemicals to try and kill the varroa.
Mm.
So, but what a great approach to actually do this.
So this is it's a behavioural mechanism in bees where they have something like 5,000 different odour receptors on their antenna. So they're really sensitive antenna, and they can detect a lot of different chemicals and odours. And actually, I was interested in her work because I'm interested in the way bees communicate through their antenna and odours. And that sort of segued me into looking at her research. And when I saw what she she'd been working on it for 10 years when I came across it. And there was a lot of scientific papers on her work that had showed that it was working, and it was at a stage where she was close to commercializing it. It had been really well field tested, and her research looked really solid. So I got in touch and said, I'm really interested in going on any field trials if you're doing any. And she basically came back and said, yes,
fantastic.
We are, and you can. I said, I'm really interested in looking at if our bees will express that behaviour here, even though we don't have a mite population to test them.
Okay, interesting. So you're looking, so getting this up and running, once again, I mentioned before, I'm going to put in the show notes, beegenetics.com.au. you're looking for funding and donations and help. Tell us what you need.
Yeah.
What do you need?
I need a couple of hundred thousand, Ben.
Yeah.
To get the project off the ground for the first 12 months. And that's just going to cover some of the costs,
yes,
not all of it, for Dr. Nadine Chapman and myself, because we'll be looking at, along with using this, it's called a UBO spray.
Okay.
We'll also be looking for genetic markers for potential resistance to varroa mite, and doing some pedigreeing work to help so that we're not inbreeding our bees that we're finding that express this trait. We're expecting, I've done about 7 months worth of looking at varroa resistance using the UBO spray in my own breeding population.
Interesting.
And found that it's about 4% of honeybees colonies will be expressing this naturally. So there's going to be quite a lot of testing.
Yes.
And work.
Work ahead, yeah.
And we really need to just see if it'll work on a bigger scale. And that if I'm going to completely dedicate myself to doing this work, which I really would like to, and do the job properly, it's going to cost about $250,000 for the first year.
Yeah, for the first year, yeah. But that's something that could really just change, the way obviously keeping bees, especially in Australia, because this whole varroa thing's new to us, but, you know, globally as well. Like this is
So it can definitely be done. Varroa resistance is definitely there. The advantage that we've got is that I'm offering my population of queens that have already been selected and bred for all these other beneficial commercial traits, and we will just be adding this one trait.
An extra.
And it's not actually a hard thing to breed for.
Okay.
It's not a difficult trait to breed for compared to some of the others that I have bred for over the past 10 years. So I think I've got a proven track record, and having the insemination skills that I have, having this big apiary of breeders, there's probably 60, 70 out there at the moment, and there's an equal number of drone mother colonies. It's a really good base to start a project like this that would normally cost millions.
Yeah, that's right, exactly.
And all we're asking is to add this one trait to a population that's already there. And at the end of it, I am going to donate those queens to the AQBBA to raise funds for the Australian Queen Bee Breeders Association.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's fantastic. And so just for the moment, so obviously money's going to help, and if there's any, you know, listeners that can help, you know, you've got, you know, donations, you know, jump on the website.
Yeah, I've got a ready fund go, or a GoFundMe type project.
Yeah, okay.
Set up, ready to go to. But if you go into beegenetics.com.au, the website, it'll link you through to the funding campaign anyway.
Yeah, that's amazing. And don't forget, people.
So it's all linked through from BeeGenetics.
And don't forget, any listeners, you know what I mean, it could be a small donation, you know what I mean? All it takes is, you know.
I need 1,998 more people to chip in $100
each. $100
each.
Or you know, even 100,000 people, you know, chip in $10 each, you know what I mean?
$10 each.
Yeah, $10 each, exactly. Yeah, that's – so other than the funding, so what else do you need? Is there anything else other than obviously the money to help, you know, get this project?
I've actually got a good team behind me. I've got the support of Australian Queen Bee Breeders Association, got the support of ARBEC, our Australian Honeybee Industry Council, have founding supporters Flow Hive. And a couple of other people have pledged amounts so far. So, and I've also got, I am still looking for some what I call UBO sponsors. So people who are accessible, hopefully, to where I am in Queensland, who could potentially have some good breeding stock that I can spray. And I'm offering some sponsorships locally around the $5,000 mark.
Yep, okay.
And if it's interstate, it'll have to be the 100 sprays, which is the $10,000 mark.
Fantastic.
That's awesome. That's very limited because there's only so much spraying one person can do. And as it stands, I'm contracted with the university in the USA. Part of the conditions of the contract is that I'm the only one that's allowed to spray.
Yeah, okay.
Unhealthy brood odor spray on colonies. So that means I have to physically be in several different places this season if this goes in.
Yes, Admiral. You'll go from 72, 78 hours a week to 92, 98 hours a week. Corinne?
I think I'm getting used to working long hours.
Yes.
I was doing 120-hour work last 3 or 4 weeks just to get this project off the ground on top of everything else.
Yeah. I can imagine.
I'm going to need a holiday between, I think.
a trip to Hawaii. Sit on the beach, on the sand beach, with a espresso martini and just relax. Corinne, that's absolutely, really appreciate your time. That was, absolute wealth of information, and that was just for the listeners and especially myself. That is absolutely incredible. So, and I'm going to put it, as I said, I'll put that.
You're welcome. Thanks. Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate you having me on.
And,
No,
I'm grateful.
It was good.
Yeah, no, thank you so much, Corinne. I really appreciate it. So, thank you once again. Really appreciate it. And for the listeners, don't forget, I'm going to put it in the show notes. Please, if you could help, any donation, big or small, it's really good because think about this. We're not just helping the bees in Australia. We're helping the bees globally. So really, it's a big deal. Big deal. And really, once again, to Corinne, thank you so much for your time. That was amazing. Like, artificial insemination, really fascinating, absolutely, utterly fascinating, absolutely hearing all that. So don't forget, if you want to hear someone, shoot me through a text, 0437077792. You can shoot me through an email. And if you want to hear someone or got a comment, you want to say something, if you want to put your name to it, no worries. You want to be anonymous, no worries at all. I'll keep it anonymous. So that is fine. And I really appreciate you listening to this. And until next time, take care of yourself, take care of each other, and take care of those bees. Bye for now.